On this beautiful fall day, when we celebrate our earth and our seventh principle, we come together in words from Barbara Peskin. For the beauty of the earth, this spinning blue-green ball, yes, Gaia, mother of everything, we walk gently across your back to come together again in this place to remember how we can live. To remember who we are, to create how we will be. Gaia, our home, the lap in which we live. Welcome us. As Hector comes forward, Hector Constanzas, our president, comes forward to light our chalice, I invite you to turn to the unison words of chalice lighting found in your order of service and join me. We light the chalice this morning for earth our home, earth abundant, source of what was before we were and will be after we are gone. As each cell proves our common destiny, may we know earth, our mother of old, as our friend. As we were bred of dust and stars, may we know her fate as ours. I'd now like to invite Lisa Gordon and Henry Gordon Ozaiden to come forward and join me up here as part of our Living Our UU Principles section of the service. The seven Unitarian Universalist principles are the values we share as a congregation. They give us our identity, and they draw others to join us. When we say we affirm these principles, we are saying that we give them our stamp of approval. When we say we promote them, we're saying we try to live by them and help others to accept them and also live by them. Today, Lisa and Henry will introduce one of the Unitarian Universalist principles and tell us what it means to them.
This fall, we're focusing on the seven UU principles. Today, we celebrate the seventh UU principle. We affirm and promote respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part.
We believe in caring for our planet Earth, the home we share with all living things.
To me, living this principle in my life means being mindful of the impact my actions have on those around me and on our environment. A simple act of caring can have a profound effect, whether it be planting a tree or guiding peepers off the road on a chilly spring night. How rich are our lives because of the shade of that tree and the song of a tiny frog. Thich Nhat Hanh said, every step we make has power to heal and transform. Not only can we heal ourselves by our steps, but we can help the earth and the environment.
To me, it means finding balance between man-made civilization and nature. We have to be careful about how we affect the earth. Before we build something like a skyscraper, we must ask ourselves, are we doing anything that can hurt Mother Nature?
In the days ahead, we ask you to be conscious of this UU principle and to think about what it means in your own life.
Please join us now in saying the words of the seventh principle as printed in your order of service.
We affirm and promote respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. thank you both for an excellent job. I now invite you to give your attention to Mike and also to turn to number 1073 in the turquoise supplement. We're going to learn, if you don't already know, and sing a Native American song, and he will lead us in that.
Earth is our mother. We must take care of her. The earth is our mother. We must take care of her. Hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young. Hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young. Her sacred ground we walk upon. With every step we take, her sacred ground we walk upon. With every step we take, hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young. Hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young. The earth is our mother. We will take care of us. The earth is our mother. She will take care of us. Hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young. Hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young. The sky is our father. We will take care of him. The sky is our father. We will take care of him. Hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young. Hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young. The sea is our sister. We will take care of her. The sea is our sister. We will take care of her. Hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young. Hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young. The forest is our brother. We will take care of him. The forest is our brother. We will take care of him. Hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young. Hey, younga, ho, younga, hey, young, young.
And I now invite you to give your attention to our Director of Religious Education, who will help us interpret that message a little. Tell you another Native American story. It's a story of a Native American grandfather. And he is telling his grandson a story. And he tells the boy that he has two wolves inside of him, and that they struggle with each other. The first is the wolf of peace and charity and love and kindness. The other is the wolf of fear and selfishness and greed and hatred. "Which wolf will win, Grandfather?" asked the young boy. "Whichever one we feed," he replied. There are two wolves in our world, and one way to feed the good wolf is through our contributions we make to this church and to those institutions and charities that we support each week. You knew I was going to get there. Those institutions that foster peace and love and kindness and generosity and world community. And one of those organizations is our Southeast India Project, which has been going now for about 9 years. Bob Tabor has taken our efforts to India, and we have supported children in orphanages, and we have created villages with sanitary facilities and a preschool that we built, and we've even gone back and reestablished them after other storms. Bob, I didn't know there was another bad cyclone in India. I don't know if it hit those same villages, but I know it was the same general area, did it? North, it was north. Well, thank goodness for that. But there's a lot of work to be done over there. And our weekly collection of both cash and checks is split 50-50 between the church and the charity, unless you make some other notation on your pledge that you wish, on your check, that you wish it applied in a specific way, like pledge only or church only or whatever. So, it's always helpful to our treasury team if you write a memo, on the check. The morning offering will be gratefully accepted and we'll hear some wonderful earth music. Going to be journey into our time of prayer and meditation this morning in song, a beautiful song that expresses our oneness of everything. Mike is going to sing it, and I invite you to take those words with you into your time of silence.
Far beyond the grasp of hands, or light to meet the eye, past the riches of the mind. There find the key to nature's harmony, in an architecture so entwined. Like the birds whose patterns grace the sky and carry all who join in love expanding, the message of peace will rise in flight, taking the weight of the world upon its wings.
ours. In the oneness of everything, peace is in the dance of trees, who stir before the first breath of wind is yet perceived. Trust in the song becoming one with the dance, and all mysteries can be believed. Songs of lives flung past that touch our own are written in the earth ever giving. And now to maintain the harmony gives to us all lives worth living. For the oneness of still we seek to find a truth that we might understand and reduce to terms defined. Vast and immeasurable time and space, also overwhelmingly designed. Oh, passing years, just might I know the faith that winters in the heart to be reborn in spring, to hear and to feel the pulse of life enters my soul as a song to sing of the oneness of everything.
This we know, the earth does not belong to us, we belong to the earth. This we know, all things are connected like the blood which unites one family. All things are connected. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the sons and daughters of the earth. We did not weave the web of life, we are merely a strand in it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. Attributed to Chief Seattle.
I was born in the mid-1950s and grew up in the 60s and 70s. I know that sounds ancient to some, like of you, but I know also that many of you here at church remember those days. And I bet if you're one of them, your experiences were much like mine. In my family, we didn't worry about the environment very much. In 1970, I received my driver's license and soon thereafter got my first car, a 1962-98 Oldsmobile, a hand-me-down from my parents. It got about 8 miles to the gallon of gas, and that didn't seem to be a problem as the price of gas back then was 35 or 36 cents a gallon. We were still a few years away from the Arab oil crisis, and the price of heating oil was very low, so we ran our furnace at home full tilt without much worry about insulation values and things like that. We did do a little bit of recycling in my family. We saved old newspapers and magazines for the Boy Scout paper drive. But we were doing it to help the scout troop earn money, not really to save the environment. And we kids might redeem soda bottles to get the nickel back so we could spend it on penny candy or some other treat. But everything else went into the trash, which we put in a big barrel in the backyard and burnt it. No one spoke of global warming or glaciers melting, polar bears going extinct, water shortages, holes in the ozone, depletion of fossil fuels, and the like. Unitarian Universalist churches were still more than a decade away from adopting our seven principles, and no one ever heard of a green sanctuary committee at church like the one we have at our church. We're certainly more aware now, and we have all taken some steps to become greener in the way we live our lives. In spite of this, the earth is actually at greater peril than it was when I was a child and we acted without even thinking about our interconnectedness to all things. Undeniable science demonstrates that there is now an urgency to address global warming and other environmental issues. But what will bring us to make the changes, not just in our own lives, but also in our society, that are required to save our planet for future generations? What is necessary to meet the resistance of selfish economic interests and antiquated worldviews that hold us back? There's ample scientific evidence, and science proposes a wealth of possible solutions. But for many, often motivated by self-interest and an unwillingness to make any real change, there still is not sufficient moral impulse, if you will, to take the kind of action that's really necessary to save the earth. As oceans and temperatures rise, there are still climate change deniers, even among our elected officials. And I think it's pretty easy to take a fatalistic attitude. But I still hold on to hope. And you might find it odd to discover where I find that hope. It's not so much in the realm of science and scientific solutions, or in the result of the political process, but in the realm of faith. That may sound crazy for me to say, but perhaps the biggest shift in thinking over the past 40 or 50 years about the role of saving our planet has actually been a theological shift. That shift has certainly taken place within our own tradition, but it has also happened and is happening more and more in traditions that are very different from ours. I don't think that anybody would argue with me that in our world community, the teachings of religious traditions profoundly impact the way people act in their personal lives and as a society. What I'm suggesting to you is that we are moving in a direction where religious traditions are embracing a greener theology. The theological world is re-examining its teachings on the relationship of human beings to the earth and all creation. They are finding old theologies and building new ones that support an earth-saving faith. Today, the words you heard read and some that you sang described our relationship to our planet and to all the natural world as one of kinship. The earth is our mother, the sky is our father, the animals, the rivers, the plants, our sisters and brothers. We certainly identify this sort of language with Native American and other earth-centered spiritual traditions. Like Native American traditions and some Eastern traditions, such as Hinduism, nature itself is divine, with rights equal to or superior to humans. It is a pantheistic rather than a monotheistic worldview. God or the holy is not outside the realm of nature, but in nature. Here, one is not in a struggle against nature, but instead makes their peace with God by making their peace with nature. In these traditions, the earth deserves reverence. It's not viewed in any of these traditions as something that is for the exclusive use or abuse of humans, but rather that we are part of an interconnected web. On the other hand, in the Western Jewish and Christian traditions in which many of us have been raised, the creation story of Genesis has been interpreted to say that the earth and all its resources, plants and animals, were created for the benefit of human beings. Ours is the earth to do with what we will. Genesis 1:28, in fact, tells humans to subdue the earth and have dominion over it. Now, there is certainly much more to that Genesis story, and we'll get to it. However, beginning with the Enlightenment of the late 17th and early 18th century, this was the part of the story that was emphasized. In relation to several of the principles that we've been discussing for the last 7 weeks, the positive impact of the Enlightenment as a movement that grew individual freedom and dignity and quality has been emphasized. And well, I guess every movement has its downsides too. The Enlightenment philosophers also taught the human journey was one of progress, moving away from the dangerous wilderness of the natural world. Unlike the savages, as they said, the sign of the advanced individual was that he was separated from nature and harnessed it for his own use. These were the foundational premises of those political philosophers of modernity like Locke and Hobbes. The Dominion text from Genesis helped to rationalize and even require ecological destruction in the name of civilization's sovereignty. It may seem strange to us as Unitarians who have our roots in the rational thought of the Enlightenment that the same thinkers whose thoughts helped to shape our democracy and create our individual rights and freedom also advanced a theory that saw humans as having lordship over the natural world. In our country, that position became solidified in the experience of the early settlers. Life was hard, and therefore nature was perceived as the adversary to be conquered. Unlike the Native Americans who were there with them, the early settlers saw the human being as separate from and above other creation. God was not in nature, but God was separate and apart. They often prayed to God for help in controlling the natural world. In the good times when the natural world was not acting as their enemy, it was their instrumentality to use as they saw fit. Theirs was certainly not a green faith. These ideas, although not often directly articulated today, are, I fear, still rooted deeply in the fabric of our society, our churches, and our government. But there's another side of the story in the Western tradition as well. That same message of kinship with the earth that was in the Native American and some Eastern traditions is there too. It's actually been in these traditions for a long time. The 12th century Catholic saint Francis of Assisi referred to the sun as his brother and the moon as his sister and expressed the same kind of kinship with all creation that we found in the Native American chant that we sang. And if we return to the creation stories found in Genesis with different eyes, as many theologians are doing now, we discover a world that's not sinister, but bountiful and without need of human control. The human, in that version, is an intricate part of the whole creation. You'll remember that in the story of Adam, the first human is created out of a bit of topsoil, just as are the flora and the fauna. You gardeners are familiar with the word humus. Its similarity to the word human is no mistake. The rich dirt from which the human was made was humus. In my reading of Genesis, the human is commanded not to abuse the environment, but to be its steward. And when read as a whole, the overriding theme of that text does not suggest subjugation that one passage may. The overriding command in the creation story is not to conquer nature, but rather for all creation to multiply and be fruitful. Elsewhere, too, in the Bible, there are many places where we can draw out an eco-theology. Noah's preservation of the species. Isaiah's sharp critique of the Assyrians for destroying an old-growth forest in Lebanon. Ezekiel denouncing the pollution of a river, just to name a few. So what I'm suggesting to you is that in all our varied faith traditions, there are teachings which provide a basis for an earth-saving faith and that call us to take action upon that faith. And those teachings are now increasingly coming to the forefront in various traditions. Recently, I learned one can find an environmental mandate in Islam. Some scholars actually consider the Quran to be greener than the Bible. Now, we are probably all familiar with the word Sharia. We know it to refer to a rather repressive code of law. But you know what the word actually means? It means source of water. The Islamic cleric Iman al-Hilali writes that Islam forbids wasting water and that preserving water is a form of worship that gives pleasure to Allah. He understands Islam to teach that all living things are partners to humans and they deserve their own respect. He goes as far as to call the earth the very same thing that the Native Americans did, our first mother. Why worry, you may say, about what the Bible or the Quran or other ancient religions say about our relationship to the earth? Well, to start, it's in part what got us to the point where we have abused the earth. But more importantly, for many in this world today, and you know this to be true, the authority of a scripture is their most compelling warrant. Maybe you're saying, let's just stick to the science. And of course, the science is important. But there will always be disputed and contra findings available for those who want to grasp onto them to continue to support their abuse of the planet. Science provides a rational and intellectual reason to act, where faith provides a spiritual and moral mandate. Science speaks more to the rational head, but an earth-saving faith speaks to the soul, to the heart, to the conscience. And we need both to save a planet. Most of us here don't require a biblical mandate for our actions, but we do need deeply rooted convictions supported by a philosophy or a theology of right relationship with our planet and all its creatures. I believe we need to do more than just reason about the problem. We need inspiration. We need to ground ourselves and especially our children in a system of beliefs that can move us from viewing our relationship to the environment as one of dominance over to one of kinship with. When at our core we have accepted that kind of understanding, then our beliefs will be and our behavior will be that of participation, cooperation, respect, and reverence for the interconnected web. Environmental policies to stop climate change, to save the earth, won't be grudgingly accepted because we know at a rational level it's necessary to survive, but instead will be joyfully embraced as the only morally and spiritually right thing to do. I'm proud to say that this is not a new idea to Unitarian Universalism. Although an earth-saving theology is just beginning to emerge in some more conservative denominations, we've been articulating a progressively greener theology for a long time. Emerson, Thoreau, and the other Unitarian Transcendentalists saw divinity in nature and tried to live in harmony rather than in opposition to the natural world. You know, perhaps the reason that Thoreau's experience at Walden Pond is so important in both our American literary and philosophical traditions is that at the time when most Americans felt the need to tame and subdue nature, he presented a model of living simply with nature, harmoniously, cooperatively. Thoreau was preaching sustainable living not as a scientific response to environmental destruction, but as a divine calling and a theological understanding of the interconnected web of life. But it was not until 1985, when we as an association of churches adopted our present set of principles and purposes, that we explicitly made this statement. You know, the first six principles, all of which relate either to the human individual or to world community, were circulated for discussion in 1984. And at the debate in 1985, the seventh principle emerged, which states that we affirm and respect the interdependent web of existence, of which we are all a part. It was added during the course of the debate. And it was not until 1995, and after a very heated debate, that we formally accepted spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature as one of the sources from which our living tradition draws inspiration and insight. We've drawn on that particular tradition this morning, celebrating our oneness with everything. The inseparable oneness with the earth and with all things, the kinship with the earth and all its creatures, is profoundly a theological belief as well as a scientifically supportable fact. Last year, I saw a PBS special called Dirt. Maybe some of you saw it. One of the speakers in that program said, "We're made of the same molecules as the stars and planets, not just the same type, but the very same molecules. We're not just metaphorically one, but actually one with all things at the molecular level." This truth is a firm foundation for an earth-saving faith. But the journey does not end with a new or deeper understanding of our oneness with all things. Now we have to marry the theological outlook of our kinship to all creation with action. We have to do more than just believe in our interconnectedness with all creation. We have to be drawn from a deep place to speak and to act. An earth-saving faith must be an embodied faith, one that we express through our daily actions, how we live, one that guides that daily living and guides our public engagement. The scale of the problem that affects our environment can seem overwhelming. It can be difficult to comprehend how it is that anything we do can possibly make a difference. But if we recognize our interconnectedness with all creation in a deeply spiritual way, such that that concept becomes a guiding force in our lives, then we will make decisions in our daily lives that make a difference. As Gandhi put it, we will be the change that we want to see for the world. Yes, we as a faith tradition commit to affirm in our living and to promote to the world a deep respect for the interdependent web of all existence. But the several hundred folks who identify themselves as 100,000 folks who identify themselves as Unitarian Universalists are simply not going to be enough to save the planet. We cannot do it alone, but it's hopeful to see how many other faith traditions are also discovering or rediscovering the principles that support an earth-saving faith. You know, there'll continue to be powerful and short-sighted economic and political issues that stand in the way of creating a greener planet. But the voices of people who at the deep level of faith have accepted their kinship with the earth, their oneness with all creation, will be a formidable force in the political debate to save our planet. Wouldn't it be wonderful if the earth were saved by a theological truth that all the religions of the world claimed in common? I truly believe that we are moving in that direction theologically. I hope we'll get there in time.